Yudave Gaura Chandraya Radhikaya Tadalaya Krishnaya Krishna Bhaktaya Tad Bhaktaya Namo Namaha Sri Sachinandan Gaur Hari Ki Jai Sri Hari Nam Sankirtan Ki Jai Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Gaur Premananda Ki Jai. So, good morning. Again, welcome. Yet another day in the life. Each day, different lifetime or a few deaths per day. So we're once talking, I remember, about Teresa, 100 deaths before lunch. A good title to, for something. And 100 rebirths, of course, at the same time. So today we're in our fifth day. I mean, there are more days, but fifth day official in terms of topics. We will be talking about the fifth of the seventh pillars of radical personalism of our Tadatmya Sangha as well, which is divine ignorance, knowing through darkness, paradox, and doubt. How all those things that may terrify us contain the deepest lessons and revelation and epiphany. But before, of course, a brief recap of what we saw yesterday. you say, the subjective experience is like a few things happen in between. It was last week, yeah. It was accurate, actually. So last week, we talked about issues and tissues between guru and disciple, right? And we tried to address different possibilities of how we shouldn't limit guru to the human figure, but we should keep in mind the universality of the guru principle. Guru is everywhere. Krishna is the original guru. Krishna is everywhere. Guru is everywhere. No? Okay. 1 second. Pause. So someone else is coming?
Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning, Lux. Yeah. Good morning, Rasangi. Too many people, sorry. It's warm. You can take your seat. So we were doing some brief recap of what we saw yesterday. We were talking. We have been talking about the seven main pillars of radical personalism. In the last part of the book, we have seven chapters, each one constituting a pillar. We have been talking first pillar, vulnerability and empowerment. Second pillar, individuation. Third pillar, non-dual thinking. Fourth pillar yesterday, I've been talking about, as we were mentioning, the universality of the guru principle. We were talking about that connection, how, of course, beyond the universal principle of the guru, there's the localized agent. And the localized agent, the guru, can be seen as a servant of the disciple's face, a servant of the disciple's potential. We use the word facilitator of potential. That's the way the guru is a facilitator of potential. And someone who accompanies the disciple on the journey, his, her journey, listens with him, with her, what Krishna wants to reveal on the journey. So we did a few exercises in connection to that as well. And then we try to go in the direction of the dangers of over-expecting and over-idealizing, not only from the disciple toward the guru, but from the guru toward the disciple as well, and how the relationship could go in the direction of mutual over-idealization. And over-idealizing means dehumanizing, as we say, because I'm making you more than what you are. Even if it's more, if it's less, it's not what you are. So in one sense, I'm not allowing you to be who you are, and all that you can be is who you are. So we gave some examples of this and talked about even as disciples, how can we use surrender as a form of not taking personal responsibility. No, I just surrender to you, Gurudev, you tell me what to do. And if, or as a way of not of insisting of a guru's extreme, exaggerated perfection, as a way of not having to offer unconditional love, because unconditional love is you may have made some mistakes on some level, and I still love you despite imperfection, so to say. We also analyze how in a particular scenario, a guru may commit some mild mistakes and it's okay. We are not being making up a rat by saying Gurudev misquoted a verse. Now the verse should, we have to edit the Bhagavad Gita so the Sanskrit fits my Gurudev's misquotation or something. No, we just need to acknowledge those things. As Vyasadeva in his own way acknowledged certain shortcomings in his own work, and that gave birth to the Bhagavatam, and that gave birth in turn to the Gaudiya Sampradaya. And we concluded touching upon the not desirable, but sometimes plausible situation where a guru, a disciple takes some distance from a guru for whatever reason. We gave the example of Bali Maharaj and how also, despite pandemonium crisis and post-apocalypse scenarios, if one is sincere, Krishna is taking the role of guru in the heart and eventually guiding in whatever direction the student has to be guided to not go astray, and a sincere practitioner will not allow anything to take the person away from the path at the same time. So in that sense, success is warranted if we are honest. So and we did a few exercises also in that connection in terms of placing unrealistic expectations and why maybe some of those were unresolved personal issues that became projection. Connection with the mentor or guide will look like. So there has been some nice sharing during the day, and yesterday night we had some circle sharing, which somehow the topic came quite naturally. So that was very beautiful. On the fifth pillar of the seven, knowing through darkness, doubt, and paradox. So I personally like this topic a lot. And it's quite connected to what we have been talking these days, because in one sense, the guru is the emblem of instruction, but also a crucial aspect of imparting knowledge is created proper doubts also. In one sense, the guru resolves doubts by answering questions and giving knowledge, but also we can create higher and deeper doubts, not to doubt about the integrity of the path, but not to doubts in the sense of don't be so sure that you got it everything perfectly, that you already understood what Krishna consciousness is about. Knowing through unknowing, letting go. So in that sense, I see the connection between guru disciples topics, as we say yesterday and today's divine ignorance. Like a guru, for example, is not, at least in my opinion, it's not supposed to just give predictable answers to every question, and everything becomes like formulaic. Not like, okay, I know what to say in every possible scenario. I have the one-liner. No? I have the formula. No? And I remain in certainty, and I keep everyone in certain. Again, there's place for that in certain stages, we already say yesterday. No? In the beginning, a baby just needs black and white answers, simple, don't complicate the whole thing, don't be nuanced, don't come with grace in between black and white, it's too nuanced, it's too much. But in time, we should open. Like today in the morning, I was listening to one podcast from Richard Rohr with a few friends he has, and it was funny, they were doing the podcast, and suddenly the a duck outside of the window was giving birth to, how to say, ducklings?
Yeah.
So they are talking, whoa, look, the duck. And the whole thing is recorded. They kept the recording, and Richard wakes up, and they start looking in the window, and it's this whole process, and they want to go out in one place. They cannot. They have to jump, open a hole in the wall, and let the ducklings come, and so on and so forth. And I forgot why I was saying this now.
Not always having a set answer. Not always the same thing that you say.
Yeah. But there was something very specific.
Listening to the podcast.
Yeah. Krishna's forgetfulness and remembrance. It will come. That was very specific, because you are allowing like no predictable answers on ducks. What's please create a bridge immediately. It's too like oh here it is. Now you will see how specific that was. I was saying that there is a place for one being a kid, a boy, a duckling, no, and just black and white, just simple things, not too new, not too many doubts. Give me certainty, please. And Richard was saying in the podcast that, oh, it's so nice to see the mother duck walking, and all the ducklings just going where the mom is going. It has its own beauty, no? for the duckling. Again, like for just whatever the mom does, the kids are like mirroring that and imitating. It has its own beauty. It corresponds for that particular chapter. So again, we are not stigmatizing the things. They have their own beauty as long as they happen in the corresponding age that should happen. But eventually, of course, as we say, the guru, in this case, going back to the guru analogy, instead of giving predictable answers, may reply by giving, as I put in my book, newly discovered questions. Because we have questions, we look for answers, but maybe the answer creates a new question. But that question takes to another answer, and so on and so forth. No? This poet Rilke, how do you pronounce it? And he'll say, like, instead, try to love the questions instead of loving the answers. Try to love the question enough so the answers will come by staying with the question. No, don't try to get rid of the questions quickly. Like, this is a question, give me the answer quickly. Stay with the question. Allow yourself to be in that space of not knowing, having the question. And gradually the question starts to blossom into the answer itself. And eventually that answer starts to blossom into another question. And that's how we progress, no? That's our quest. We were talking with Jai Jagannath in Michigan, this language. We have a question, and the question sets us on a quest. Mm-hmm. And at one point, the quest is fulfilled. We reach some plateau, some new status quo is formed. A new question needs to come to break that pattern and set us on a further quest, on a further journey. So it's important that as disciples, as students, that we are all, like Srila Siddharth will say, students forever. Sometimes we love to receive answers. No, we don't love to receive questions. We don't love to have questions. But it's important to stay with that. No? Sometimes we love more closure than disclosure. No? Let's bring closure. Let's conclude, make it clear. I know, certainty, predict. Whew. And it's fine. We need some orders, uncertainty. We kind of just been thrown into chaos forever and remain sane in our mind. No? But also too much order, too much predictability becomes dangerous, becomes suffocating. If everything is predictable, if everything is under control, if everything is certain, starts to look like Nazi Germany, no? like a totalitarian regime. Everything is in place. Everything has a way of being. Whatever transgresses the template needs to be eliminated, basically. So too much order, dictatorship. Too much chaos, madness. So we need a middle point between order and chaos, so to say, right? So so it's, for me, it's healthy to see that answers are bridges that take us to further questions. See, if I receive an answer, let's not bring closure with an answer. Okay, I have the answer. No need to talk anymore about that. We can go further. We can go further about that. I like to read first the epigraph. Epigraph, you say in English? Mm-hmm. Oh, epigraph? Epigraph. Epigraph. Okay, I was... This is an epigraph from Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. He's a Christian mystic, theologian, scientist, very interesting, paleontologist, among other things. So this is how the chapter begins. Very interesting words. In terms of coexisting, relating to God, the principle of mystery, the principle of unknowing. he says, God does not offer himself to our finite beings as a thing all complete and ready to be embraced. For us, he is eternal discovery and eternal growth. The more we think we understand him, the more he reveals himself as otherwise. The more we think we hold him, the further he withdraws, drawing us into the depths of himself. So that's just to set the tone of what we are talking about today here. And the more we try to capture God, understand Krishna, and bring closure to the infinite, as absurd as that may sound, we may try that every day. Let's bring closure to the infinite. Let's capture, let's limit, let's understand it. The more we will feel, the more he will show that he's, that's not how the relationship can work. As we were saying the other day, remember the quote that I shared from Richard Rohr in this connection? Mm-hmm. If you remember it, you can quote it.
The experience of God today is an obstacle for the experience of God tomorrow.
Hmm. Yeah, the last experience of God is frequently the greatest obstacle to the next experience of God. So that's basically the same thing with other words. Because as we were talking also these days, Krishna is ever evolving. Krishna is ever evolving. So Krishna is not a fixed entity, a static being that is always the same. But he's always becoming more. He's always growing. He's always evolving. Carl Jung will say, what in the morning was true, in the evening have become a lie. Another way of saying the same thing, right? Yeah. No. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur will say, today's perfection is tomorrow's imperfection. Like trying to make it clear how the dynamic of life is in constant growth and movement and unfolding. So how much we can try to understand and bring closure to something that is constantly evolving. So in that sense, God is an eternal mystery. And not only God, as we will see, everything, including ourselves. There's always a part of us that we can, is waiting to be discovered. No? It's a potential accompanying us that still to be embraced. So we, in one sense, we remain an eternal mystery unto ourselves. And we should be okay with that. That's an important point. Okay, it's okay to coexist with mystery. That's maybe the main thing that we want to share today. As I like to mention in the book, to put it in more contemporary words, don't take Krishna consciousness for granted. Don't think, I already know what it means to be devotee. I don't really know what kirtan is, prasadam is, sadhusanga is, guru is, Krishna is, bhakti is. We have that tendency. Something which is extraordinary, we take it for granted that it becomes ordinary. No. Let's go for kirtan. Okay, yeah, another kirtan. Let's go. Prasad. Oh, yeah, I'm so hungry. Let's eat. Oh, no, prasad. Divine grace. Sadhusanga. Okay, social gathering. No, social gathering. Sadhusanga is something else. So sometimes we are surrounded by extraordinary items, by extraordinary people, by extraordinary moments of sharing and experiences. But sometimes we lose sight of the extraordinariness and we need to be reminded on a daily basis. And in this way, don't take Krishna consciousness for granted, because Krishna consciousness is always becoming more of what it is. Krishna consciousness is not one fixed thing that will be always the same. It's always becoming more, because Krishna is always becoming more, right? We talk these days. Therefore, Krishna consciousness is always becoming more, because Krishna consciousness is about being conscious of Krishna. Now, Krishna consciousness means be conscious of that person who is always becoming more. So therefore, the process of doing that is always becoming more in itself. You follow my point? Love someone who is ever evolving. The very process of loving that person is ever moving. Krishna is always becoming more Krishna, as we say these days. And more attractive, and more Krishna, more attractive. Krishna is Krishnaizing himself at every moment, updating his own beauty, upgrading his own charm. So Krishna consciousness is just a process to catch up with that, so to say, to catch up with Krishna's ever-increasing beauty. Krishna, wait a minute. Wait. I'm trying to catch up with that and honor that and serve that properly. So the exact opposite of that is just take things for granted and enter into this space of certainty, of like closure. I know what this is. You know, this famous quote of Mark Twain, I shared it in my book. He says, maybe you know it, but he says, it ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so.
What?
Sam says, what? So, should I read it again?
Yeah, because Mark Twain's...
I go again.
Yeah.
It ain't. Ain't is like all English? You don't use that, right? Yeah. It is not what? Okay, it isn't. Okay. I'll keep the, we are in old house, let's keep the old English as much as it. It ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble, son. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. Penny, you explained that to Sam. He's not getting it yet.
Yeah, I don't get it.
Okay, Penny.
Well, it isn't what you know that gets you into trouble. It's what.
No, it's not what you don't know.
It's not what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know that gets you.
It's what you know. It's what you.
If you think you
know
something so
good. Oh, okay.
Yeah. You got it?
Yeah,
it's sure. Be honest. We are in vulnerable space here. We have been crying for the last 3 days. You can be relaxed.
Yeah, we are better because we think we know.
It's okay not to know. It's the whole team.
I don't know, so you should just move.
one last try. I will try to explain. He says, it's not what we don't know many things. So we may think, oh, I will get into trouble by not knowing things. He says, no, the actual trouble is the things you know that you are certain about, that you are too sure, I know this, I know this. And actually what you know, or what you think you know, probably you don't know either. It can be known so much more deeply. He now understands even less. It's not about you, it's about us. We are terrible explainers.
It feels like you're going, they don't know that we know they know we know.
It sounded like that.
Okay. Let's move on.
It can be explained later.
Okay.
With pictures.
I will create the new I will make the new exercise so we can explain this course. Anyhow. So the point is that we have knowledge, we know things, and sometimes that knowledge may create some toxic sense of certainty, no? Especially, I don't know, in our tradition, for example. I mentioned that in my book, in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, there's so much detailed information about everything. Now we know the name of, I don't know, of God's ankle belts. They have a name and we know it. That's a level of extreme, ultra, hyper detailed, specified description of everything. So that can take us naturally to a place of certainty, extreme certainty, because we know everything. And you start to compare with other traditions. They don't know even that. They don't even know the color of God's body. We know the name of his ankle belts. So, I mean, now you develop some superiority complex, and you can go to a very toxic place of, I don't need to know anything else because we know everything. So we are not in ignorance. So closure, that's it. This is Krishna consciousness. Here's the package, right? And it's beautiful, all the detailed information. Of course, I have nothing against that. But sometimes also an overwhelming amount of detailed information can prevent transformation. We can become too complacent and we know so much. Yeah, but what you are doing with that information? That's still information, if that's not processed to the point of transformation. And what to speak of, again, you can say, okay, Krishna's body is blue, but it's not blue. It's not blue as you think of blue. We don't have a clue of what type of blue. Just to use a word that somehow gives some point of reference. But that's just like finger pointing to the moon. No, don't become attached to the finger pointing. You have to have the experience of the moon. So and that's ever evolving. Now, the blueness of Krishna is never the same thing. Again, he's always evolving. So whatever you want to talk about Krishna, his ankle bell, that's never the same. It's an ever-evolving ankle bell. His blueness is ever-evolving. So we can never like finally fully capture anything of that. It always remains a mystery on some level. On some level. Like, no, it's not that, by this I don't mean you cannot understand God. I mean, you can understand him endlessly. You follow? It's not the same. We are not saying here you cannot know anything about Krishna. It means there's no end to how much you can experience. So be careful of putting a top limit to that. Because again, too much information, too much detailed information can make us immune to mystery. So to say, whatever something is mysterious, I'm like feeling unsettled. Do you want some tea or something to drink? No problem. Okay. And when there is absolute certitude, there's no vulnerability left. We're talking about vulnerability. Each one of the topics we're talking are kind of cumulative, are included in the next one. No, I'm not going to the details of how that's taking place. I'll leave it to you. But for example, this, not coexisting with the unknown, that's a vulnerable space to realize that. And many times we look for absolute certainty to avoid being vulnerable. But the point is that faith without vulnerability, how much of a faith that is. A faith devoid of this exposure, this coexisting with the infinite. As I say, we say on the day of vulnerability, we are naked in front of the infinite at every moment. That's quite vulnerable. Yeah. Of course, it's a loving infinite, no? So that makes safe space. It's not a dangerous infinite. But it's infinite. Infinite is infinite possibilities. So faith has to be, again, has to be open to disclosure, has to be open to news, has to be open to vulnerability, has to be open to uncertainty, to coexisting with what we don't know. As we say the other day, quoting again Father Richard, he will say, what's the opposite of faith? And he will say,
certainty.
Okay. now you got it. It's tricky, the question. I know. Every time I ask a question, my intention is that nobody will answer what I'm expecting the answer. It's part of the trick. So the opposite of... Sorry? Yeah. You already know, you can anticipate. That's what whenever I ask the question, I say, those who know. So the opposite of faith is certainty. Sometimes we'll think the opposite. The opposite of faith is uncertainty. Faith is all about certainty. It's a certainty trip. No, faith is about coexisting with mystery, with an eternal, ever-evolving mystery. And the opposite of faith is not doubt either. Doubt has a role in nourishing faith. Because if we understand doubt as the opposite of faith, whatever represents a doubt is like, I had to take this out of my way because it has nothing to do with faith. But there is place for doubts nourishing our faith. So we can have faith in doubts. There's place for that. Like we say, like the role of the guru sometimes is to create doubts in a healthy way, not every form of doubt, but when the teacher is saying, okay, the student is becoming too rigid, too certain, too complacent, too much taking Krishna consciousness for granted, let's say something that changed the paradigm, and you're like, oh my God, I thought I understood that, and I realized I have no clue about it. So that's part of the role of the guru, to keep the student in a place of learning, no? Never like addicted to certainty, because that's the tendency we have. We grasp some security, something certain, and we go there, because we all need security and certainty. And it's not a bad word. The point is when we become addicted to that, and it's just too much. And someone says, let's go for a walk outside. No, here it's safe. No, we need a little bit of exposure to liminal space, so to say, right? And we need to embrace uncertainty, because the moment we reject uncertainty, we limit ourselves in all how much more we can know. In other words, when we embrace uncertainty, only then we can know unlimitedly. I'll repeat. When we embrace uncertainty, only then we can know unlimitedly. Because uncertainty means I open myself to all that I don't know, which is way more than what I know, by the way. And by opening to that uncertainty, I can know all that unlimited stuff that I don't know. And of course, when I'm saying knowing, I'm not here talking about just intellectual information. I'm talking about inner experience. No? Mm-hmm. The ultimate knowing is not a head issue. Right? And again, as I mentioned, many of us, just to be honest and to be vulnerable and to be honest, many of us are pretty, we may be insecure people in many ways. In our insecurity, we look for certainty. But sometimes we look too much for certainty as a way of coping with our own insecurity. And we need to heal our insecurity so we can be okay with uncertainty. Because spirit, as I quote in my book, religion is not meant to give us certitude, but it is meant to give us patience with mystery. Religion, a spiritual tradition, mystical school, is not meant to give us certitude. No? Again, in the beginning, it may be like that. Okay, these are the list of certitudes. This is the formula. Tuk, tuk, tuk. Okay, I know what it means to be a devotee. 4 recs, 16 rounds, Mongol Arctic. As yes, we were talking, who was talking the other day? Anuradha. Sorry, like this. Part your hair like that. Braid like that. Tea like it's that. You know it. There you are. You are in. You are in. That's it. No? Just a few years from Golok Vrindavan. That's it. You don't need to do anything else. You don't need to think. Don't need to go deeper. Don't need to go to Padmanabhaswamy's classes and all that complex stuff. Just follow the formula. But that's not. I mean, again, there's place for that. There's place for the ducklings to just imitate the mom duck. But at one point, mom duck may tell the ducklings like, "Get out." Yeah. Have your life. And most of the animals do that, like, okay, and they don't see each other anymore once in a lifetime. It's like, okay, have your life now. Right? Interesting. So religion is not meant to give us certitude. Religion is meant to give us patience with mystery. Now, that's real mystical education. Reality is mysterious. The word mystery is not bad. Mystery is connected to mystical. Mystery means mystical presence. No? So it's not bad. These are not bad words. Again, as these days we have been trying to de-stigmatize, unstigmatize some terms. Some of them also, if I sometimes say mystery, we all may feel like scary. No? Like entering the church. It's mysterious. I don't know what's going on the other side of the door. I just peep and it's like, no, I want you 20 with me when I open the door. And again, it's okay. We're afraid of what we don't know. We're afraid of what lies outside of our area of control. We feel what may happen. We may not be fully grounded in in trust and confidence. No, I'm not talking about Jamuna and the church, because in some cases you are correct. I won't enter that place. I may be dangerous, who knows. We are talking more about the inner landscapes here. No? So, yeah, patience with mystery. That's a good way of speaking about faith. No? Like, tolerating, I have to be patient, I have to wait. No, but patience, no? Like the willingness to coexist with that thing that you cannot control. How willing I am to coexist with things that are clearly out of my control. How willing, even if that happens in a relationship, no? In a relationship, we love each other, we like each other until and unless something starts to clearly go out of my control. At that point, it's like, I don't like this. Or probably more specific, I don't like you. And it's not about the other person, it's just that something starts to be out of control. And I don't like to acknowledge that fact because it's confronting. But that's how reality operates. Most of the things are outside of your control. And it's okay. That's the most important part. Like this quote that I sometimes share, that once I saw, I still remember, I was in Argentina, in Buenos Aires. It was at the time that we will do photocopies. Mm-hmm. So that old, good old times.
Yeah.
I was giving whatever, some lecture, some seminar, and I will give some paper to everyone. So I went and printed my Word file with my pen drive and looking, waiting for the photocopies. And the place have this little place where people put their own stuff, like their business or their
bulletin board.
How is it going?
Bulletin board.
Bulletin board. And there was one that this was not any publicity. It was just like a type of Buddhist monk or something sitting on a rock in the midst of the lake, you know, like the very sent postcard. And there was a phrase, relax. Everything is out of control. Yeah. Sounds counterintuitive for us, no? How will I relax if everything is out of control? Of course, everything is out of control means everything's out of your control. Almost everything is out of your control. It doesn't mean that you have no agency or responsibility, but in comparison to the infinite, I mean, don't have over expectations about yourself. You are not the infinite, so relax.
No, it's not.
Charlie. Relax, everything's out of control.
No.
Sleep, Charlie. Relax. Relax, Charlie. Yeah, he wants a fly. Yeah. So we are talking about coexisting with things that lie outside of our control. And our goal in life is divine love, prem, and that's pretty unpredictable, right? I mean, we are hitting, like pointing to a goal that is clearly beyond of our control. No? Rupa Goswami says, Hari Bhavrim Nash, snake, which means it's not a straight line that you can predict. Now it's going here, straight, so by the calculations, if he goes straight for this, I will catch him there. No? It's like crooked, zigzag. You don't know what's the next movement. No? That's how love moves, unpredictable. But that was keeps the whole thing full of awe and wonder. No? When everything becomes predictable, it becomes boring. Yeah, I don't really know what will happen. It goes here, here, here. But if everything is unpredictable, that keeps us in a state of chamatkar or astonishment. No? And the scriptures say rasa sar chamatkar. The essence of rasa is astonishment. The essence of love is astonishment. To maintain ourselves in that spirit, childlike, Jesus will say, childlike spirit of wonder. Wow. At everything and anything. Constant discovery. I think we were talking with, I don't know who, was some days ago about the Rasa Lila and the gopis running after Krishna's flute. Who was talking about that? Maybe some of the ones who already left. But how the gopis are willing to do that? They hear the flute every single day, and every single day is new, and they're just running after the sound and willing to rediscover Krishna, to meet the new Krishna without any consideration, absolute unpredictability, no? Trying to go through so many challenges and obstacles, so much risk involved in the dynamics of the Leela, going running after an extramarital affair, no? I mean, try to enter into the psychology of the situation. Imagine if you have, I mean, in one sense, it will be impossible for it to succeed unless it's yoga maya in between making all the arrangements. Imagine if you have a secret lover, each one of you, but you're already married, you have all your daily responsibility, but you're successfully able to run away for a rendezvous every single night with that person without being caught. That sounds like you can do it once, twice, a few times, but at one point it's like, come on. every night and they're doing it, and they're willing to do it, and they're willing to risk everything, because every night is uncertainty for them. It's not like it's totally safe, it's totally secure, we know what will happen, everything is perfectly arranged. No clue. No, the flute sounds and they are out of them for an adventure, and they don't know what will happen. And sometimes Krishna will play the flute, they will appear like in the grass, in the bath, and Krishna will say, "What are you doing here? No. I mean, it's so late. I'm a young boy, single. I am the heir of the throne of Nanda Baba. I'm the prince." And what will people think if I'm with a bunch of married ladies at night? One boy, many ladies in the forest. That sounds awkward. And the gopis are like, "But you called us." But Krishna is speaking these crooked verses in Sanskrit, which have double meaning. So it seems that he's saying, "Go back home." And at the same time, he's saying, "You have nowhere else to go apart from staying here with me." So it's like, is he meaning this? Is he meaning that? No. So you can try to imagine the vulnerability of the gopis and the uncertainty and the situation they're being put every single night. But they run after that mystery over and over again, over and over again. Hearing the flute, running to the midst of the forest, full night. Oh, mystery, mystery, mystery. And they love the mystery. They don't want Krishna to stop being like that, although they may complain externally and chastise him and so on at times. But if Krishna will start to be different, they will start to really complain there. Mm-hmm. No? So Krishna is a mystery, and we have to preserve the mystery. No, mystery is not to be, what's this word that sometimes is used? Plundered. No? There's one Buddhist saying, don't plunder the mystery with concepts. I don't speak Croatian, sorry. I cannot say the specific word.
Yeah, but
like desecrate? As close as I can get. Yeah. You go to a place and plunder the place, you take everything from the place, destroy the place, like harass? No, that's not the word.
No, you're taking it.
That takes there.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah. So,
from breaking, destroying. Yeah.
So yeah, don't plunder the mystery with concepts. No? We have concepts, ideas, but we cannot just fully explain the mystery with a concept. That will be a plundering of it.
It's like an arrogant thing.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Mm-hmm. Instead of humility in front of the mystery, will be like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, this Christian mystic, he will say, the role of the theologian is to preserve the mystery. No. And this doesn't mean that we have to be intellectually lay infinite and try to say as much as we can, trying to think as much as we can, trying to get all our faculties as much as we can. But mystery remains mystery. Mm-hmm. So at one point, we have to preserve mystery in the sense of, instead of let's try to solve the mystery forever so it is no longer mystery. That doesn't work, because Krishna is ever evolving. So as we will see, he will be even a mystery to himself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So again, someone who can be endlessly understood. Mm-hmm. So we have to be careful about which are our ideas. A few thoughts and we'll go to one exercise now. we have to be careful about our ideas about Krishna. Our ideas about God and God are not the same thing. God and our ideas about God, they are not necessarily equal, right? Because generally our ideas are, again, closure. This is Krishna. This is Krishna, checking all the boxes. And Krishna is 108 steps ahead already now, from my own ideas about him. So we have to keep ourselves in an open space, what all he is. Christianity have this nice book called The Cloud of Unknowing. It's a very interesting piece of mystical writing. Cloud of Unknowing, referring to God. We have this in our tradition, we call Krishna Ghanashyam, which is dark cloud. So it's like a cloud, something misty, no? Mystical, mysterious, dark, no? Not clearly, like figurable. You can figure it out very quickly. So in one sense, we can say, for me came this idea once, I'm a theistic agnostic. Mm-hmm. Not because agnostic is someone who says, I don't know. So I believe in God, but I don't know. I mean, not that I don't know if I believe, but I cannot say that I know him fully. So I know Krishna, but I don't know Krishna. So there is some agnosticism there. A healthy one, hopefully. Like I can say, I don't know. I can be okay saying, I don't know. Sometimes we feel this pressure that you cannot not know something, especially if you're a sannyasi, a guru, a speaker. Mm-hmm. You have to have an answer for everything, but that's not normal. Sometimes you don't know things. That's normal. That's the norm. We ignore more things than the ones we know. Like once someone asked Srila Prabhupada, Chapra, who was the, I don't know what they asked me, something like the yoga avatar for Trita Yuga. I say, I don't know. Like implying, why you are caring for that? Like, be careful of not becoming like too curious intellectually and miss the point. Like, no. I mean, we have enough to process what Mahaprabhu came to give. That was kind of the spirit of his answer. But he was brave enough to say, I don't know. I don't know how the disciples process that. It's a lila. He's testing. Like we were saying the other day, for some devotees, it's not possible to acknowledge the guru may not know something. So he says he doesn't know. It's not true, actually. He's testing our faith. He knows everything. Yeah. Like I remember I was talking with one devotee, and he told me, I was in the class with Guru Maharaj, and he was about to quote a verse, and he didn't remember the verse. And he asked us, and I was so, and I realized at that moment, actually, he's testing me, because he cannot not know the verse. And I was like, I'm not sure. Uh-huh. Probably he forgot the verse. It's fine. You can forget verses. That happens. Anyhow, our ideas about God are not necessarily God. In order to know God, many times we have to unknow God. In order to know Krishna, we need to unlearn. Big part of learning is unlearning. This is this famous quote from Meister Eckhart. Maybe you heard about him. He's a Christian mystic. And he will say, it's funny, you have to understand the context. He says, God, rid me of God. God, rid me of God. You know what's rid? Get rid me of God. No? Like implying, God, please rid me of my ideas about you who are not you. No, God rid me of my own idea about God. So it's a famous line. He will pray to God for that unlearning and remaining open to a new version.
So basically, the only thing we have to know is we know nothing.
Well, that's pretty Socratic. Why not? He will say that. The only thing I know is that I don't know. Of course, it's not that we know nothing, but by in comparison to all that can be known, the subjective experience may be, I know nothing. And that's why we hear so many times, I was going there. Especially because for us, knowing ultimately means loving. No? Krishna says in the Gita, Raja Vidya, when he's speaking about bhakti. Bhakti means love. Raja Vidya means the king of knowledge. So love is the king of knowledge. When I love you, I know you in the most comprehensive way. So knowing God means loving God. So if I cannot know, if I cannot know God fully means I cannot love him fully. What do I mean by this? You can have pure love, but you can always love Krishna more. That's what I mean. You cannot love him fully. You can always love him more fully. Again, words are limited, but you get my idea.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That's why, and the point is that when you have love, or like you have knowledge of love is the highest knowledge, you get a glimpse of how much more love you can have. So by comparison, your subjective experience is I have nothing. Although you have it. No? That's why Mahaprabhu is the, even by Christian mystics, some Christian will describe Mahaprabhu as nobody exhibited the symptoms of love of God that Sri Chaitanya did. I mean, these are people from other traditions referring to Mahaprabhu. Like he exhibited love like nobody else. And what will Mahaprabhu say about it? Na prima gandasti darapi harome. In me, there is not even this scent, the aroma of prem, of love. So that's paradoxical. He has more love than anyone else, but his experience is, I have nothing. Not even the aroma. Not the example given is like if you have in a little box some camphor.
Mm, yeah.
Okay, but I take away the camphor. I still, you can smell it. He said, in me, there's not even that. But when you see him, you say, I don't believe you, Mahaprabhu. No, you are a golden volcano of divine love. But his subjective experience is different because he's seeing, by having so much love, you can see how much more love can be experienced. It's very paradoxical. So it's similar to what you are saying, Socrates. All that I know is that I don't know. He knew pretty much. He knew a lot. But that made him see the boundless ocean of further knowledge by comparison. I'd like to give the example of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. This is even more shocking. Bhaktivinoda Thakur will say in some of his songs, I am full of lust. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting statement. What to do with that? Now, should I say, one option is he was full of lust indeed. And it's like, no, that's not real. That's not true. Mm-hmm. Second, maybe he was thinking about us. So he wrote this song like for you to identify with it. But you can feel that he's feeling that. It's not that he's a calculated composition. So how can he be feeling that he's full of lust? A few verses after that, he's saying, and I realize I'm Kamala Manjari. And it's like, he's revealing his eternal identity in the Leela. And a few songs before, he's saying, I'm full of lust. So it's like, what to do with that? What came once to me as a revelation, and again, it's not my own merit or anything, it came just as a gift. So you may agree with that or not, of course, but for me it came very true as this idea that Bhaktivinoda Thakur has divine love, and when you have divine love, again, you can see how much more divine love you can have. So in comparison to how much love you can have, you look at your own love and you feel, I'm full of lust. No? Like a subjective experience of between the contrast of what you have and all that's waiting for you. Srila Siddhartha Maharaj will say, when you approach the infinite, you will realize that there is no limit to progress. No, there's no limit to how much progress you can. It will be overwhelming. Not as in a bad sense. It will be very humbling. If I stand in front of, like you stand in front of the ocean, it's humbling.
Mm-hmm.
You're in front of something that you cannot see the beginning, the end. Wow. But you don't feel bad. It's not like the ocean is insulting me. I feel attacked by the boundless. No, it's like, something like that. So in that sense, again, we can never love Krishna fully in the sense that you can always love him more. That's why Keno Upanishad will say, one who claims to know God, he doesn't know God. One who claims to not know God, he does know God. Of course, it's not just saying it, but if it comes from a place of genuine. So God is not to be understood or to bring closure. No? One last quote and we go to the exercise. St. Augustine will say, if you understand it, it's not God. Basically. No. If you think you feel I understood it, then it's not God. It cannot be God. That's not the nature of God. It's something else. Even if you think it's God, that's not God. Because you have brought closure to the infinite. And that cannot happen. You bring closure to the infinite, it's no longer infinite. So, sorry, I extended myself a little bit, but it's an interesting topic. Mm-hmm. I'd like to share with you one exercise that we can do now. And then we'll go back for a very short closing. So I still think I'm trying to finish at the legal time. So I would like to make an exercise where we can experience the challenge of understanding the unknowable through dialogue. So let me see. 1, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12. You are leaving in a few minutes, right? Okay. Okay. So without Martina, actually, we are good number for pairs. First, so the idea is that we can divide into pairs, and one person will play the role of someone who is absolutely certain about God. No, so you have to express yourself in those terms: closure, certainty. You are on a certainty trip, right? No, and the other person will take the position of Saint Augustine, so to say. If you understand it, it's not God. I mean, I'm not saying you just repeat that quote over and over again. It may end up in a little rushed conversation, like, stop saying that to me. But you will reply from that place, not trying to remind the other person, like trying to dismantle the certainty, so to say. And then we will switch turns and we'll play the other part. No? So the idea is that we experience how does it feel to defend both certainty and unknowing. No? And so we will do that like not too long. We can do it like 2-3 minutes, one role, 2-3 minutes, the other role. And then you can share between the two of you for 5 minutes. So totally we are 10 minutes. So you can find some places and do the exercise and reflect then on how it felt. Sorry, Mains, for interrupting. Okay. So we are back. The main word I heard was part of the idea to go through those uncharted territories and explore those places and try to see how it feels. So after the exercise, I want to conclude with three verses that somehow bring closure to the conversation today. I will leave it open for further disclosure. No, and these are three verses. First one is, let's say, God talking about us, talking about God, in terms of what we have been talking so far. First, and these are verses I like to quote always, is Bhagavad Gita, second chapter, verse 29, where Krishna is describing the soul in terms of Ascharyabhat, Sanskrit term that he repeats three times in the verse and translates as amazing, amazing, amazing. Three also can mean like, yeah, astonishing, shocking, miraculous.
Wow.
So Krishna is saying all that stuff to each of you three times. No, you are shockingly amazing. Yeah, and we will say that part because potential, as we talked the other day. So we have an infinite potential in bhakti, in connection to God, to love. So in that sense, our potential is in one sense. We talked the other day a little bit about how that should look like. To the radicals in terms of becoming, doing, being, what's all that we can be. And we say something, but we cannot just put it in like, this is all that you can be, closure. No? So in that sense, it always is an open door. It's a mystery. We are a mystery unto ourselves in terms of we don't know what's the limit of all that we can be. So we have to learn to coexist with us being a mystery to us, so to say, right? And I mentioned in my book that sometimes our potential in terms of the darkest potential, the soul, we have a darkest potential. We can go in the darkest directions and do the worst of the worst, and that's scary enough. That may be also scary, but the mere fact that it's unknown. No. I don't know which is my brain. And because I don't know something, I become unsettled because I don't know it. So it's important that we deal with our brightest potential in a way that is sustainable and it doesn't make us nervous to the point of not wanting to go there. So yeah, there's no limit to how much progress we can make. The soul is amazing. It's a unit of endless potential. Therefore, it remains a mystery to itself. So that's what Krishna is telling to us. You're amazing, three times, beautiful, incredible, and a mystery. So better you are okay with mystery because you are a mystery to yourself forever. Then the second verse is one of the prayers of Brahma in chapter 14 of the 10th canto. In the beginning, Brahma was more about figuring out Krishna, right? Like he met Krishna at the beginning of creation. They shook hands. He had some experience. And now he's seeing Krishna again in Vrindavan in a picnic with his friends. That was a very, very different setting from his first darshan. First darshan was very like going to visit the president or the pope or something like that. It was more like formal. Not everything like, okay, Brahma was like, okay, Krishna's my guru. He instructed me. And now he goes, and Gurudev is in picnic. No? No? Like you only met the Pope at the Vatican. I've been in the Vatican a few weeks ago, and it's all like formalities. Like, okay, everything. You have to know how to walk, how to breathe, how to look, how to... So you, that was your only meeting with the Pope, and the second one, he's in picnic with his buddies. No? And it's like, I don't know if that's the Pope. He may be an imposter. No? Let's test him. Let's challenge him. So that was what Brahma did somehow. No? He met Krishna in the zenith of informality in Vrindavan, not barefoot, walking. And as we know, in the picnic, they were eating with their hands, left hand. Krishna taking something and putting the remnants on the mouth of his friend, taking the remnants out of the mouth of another friend and tasting that himself. And Brahma was like, no? Remember, scriptures say if you practice Varnashram for 100 lifetimes without failure, which is basically impossible, you are born as Brahma. Which means how Brahma is aware of the proper things to do and all the rules and regulate. And now he's seeing this show of like this shattering of all that, no? Full informality. Not, I mean, you don't eat with left hand, you don't eat something and put that in the mouth of anyone else. And that's supposed to be God? No? That's supposed to be Krishna. Brahma is like this too much. No? Again, he was certain about, I know who Krishna is. And then he sees all that. He thinks this is an imposter. And we know how the story ends. His foreheads are spinning like crazy. Bimohan, no, full bewilderment for Brahma. And then comes all these beautiful prayers. And at one point, let me read the verse. Brahma is saying, those who say that they know Krishna, let them know or let them say. No? Like implying, I was one of those 5 minutes ago. Right now he has been converted to mystery. And Brahma said, those who say they know Krishna, I was one of them, let them know, let them say whatever they want. As far as I'm concerned, I do not wish to speak very much about this matter. I'm still so, oh my lord, he's saying to Krishna, let me say this much. As far as your opulences and qualities are concerned, they're all beyond the reach of my mind, body, and words, period. That's the only thing I can say, Brahma says. Apart from that, you're a mystery. So again, the first verse that I quoted was Krishna speaking about the soul being a mystery to itself. Now we have a soul speaking about Krishna, saying, you are a mystery to myself. I cannot understand you. I try my best. And Brahma has pretty good understanding capacities. He has four heads, four very sober, skillful, sharp heads, and they collapsed, the four of them. he's making this point. You are an eternal mystery as well to me. But if this is not enough, then we have to reach the last point, which is not only we are mystery to ourselves, God is a mystery to us, but God is a mystery to himself. Since we are talking about coexisting with mystery and the unknown. So there's one verse in the Bhagavatam, 10th canto, chapter 87, verse 41. All these verses we quote in the book as well. And there the personified Vedas are praising Krishna. With very beautiful taste and accuracy. And they say, because you are unlimited, neither the lords of heaven nor even yourself can ever reach the end of your own glories. So you cannot, you yourself cannot find a limit to your glories because there's no limit to your glories. So you cannot fathom the full depths of yourself. And of course, for us as Gaudiya Vaishnava, that means ultimately someone like Mahaprabhu. Mahaprabhu is Krishna himself exploring his own heart in the form of Radha. Radha is Krishna's heart. So in one sense, you could say Mahaprabhu is Krishna exploring his own heart and finding this has no end. And that's why Gaur Lila is eternal. We need that Gaur Lila is eternal because there is no end to the exploration in which God is investing himself perpetually, trying to fathom the depths of his heart and finding, I don't know, I'm a mystery to myself as well. And he's okay with that. Well, Krishna's okay with being a mystery to ourselves and to himself. So better we also are okay with mystery because we want to relate to him as mystery. We are a mystery to ourselves. He's a mystery to himself. We are a mystery to each other on some level. On some level, again, there is certainty, there is knowledge, there is experience, but there's place for mystery in eternity. So, a few thoughts to conclude our presentation on divine ignorance and knowing through paradox, doubt, and mystery. We'll have Q&A later, so I don't want to overextend, but if there is any urgent sharing that you would like to present before the evening sharing, questions, something. Yeah, Yamuna.
How to not be scared of our doubting? How to not be scared of our own doubting? I mean, you have covered it, you have spoken about it, but just specifically just honing in on that, that, you know, it put being unfamiliar and feeling the liminal space to be a very unsafe space to be in means that no, you know, this is like me speaking personally, means that doubting is a failure. It's not a good place to be because there's so much certainty, been taught with so much certainty. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, what you say, someone asks you that same question.
Oh, I've gone blank.
Imagine if Radha Vinod comes to you, your beautiful, darling son, your Radha Vinod. He comes, Mom, how to deal with this? And he presents you that question.
I'd say it's okay to be there in uncertainty, to be in the mystery of what is yet to unfold. It simply hasn't unfolded yet. And even though you're scared, it's okay. It's okay to be in that space because just give it time. Give it time and it will, and Krishna will unfold for you what is the next thing that for you to be, next stage for you to be in.
Mm. Yeah, you see, you have the answer to your question. Beautiful. I couldn't have put it better. That's why I asked you to say the answer.
When are you giving class?
She's giving class right now. Yeah, that's beautiful. I appreciate especially the point of it's okay to feel like that. Because again, you say, okay, I'm scared in doubt. And okay, own it. No, it's okay. Accept it. Acknowledge that you're feeling. Because many times we don't want to inhabit those spaces. So it's okay. And of course, always we have the bigger picture of Krishna's unconditional love, Krishna's unconditional acceptance. Because that's the bigger picture. No, it's not a doubt and my uncertainty is just all that exists. That's happening in one spot. of the picture, but the bigger picture is I'm being contained and held, hold and supported by and nourished by Krishna's unconditional love in the context of me experiencing that particular doubt. So yeah, that gives more support to trust and remaining there, and the trust of, as you say, unfolding and reminding ourselves when we feel those things, it's not that it will be like that forever. Because we have that tendency of feeling something and it feels like this will last for eternity. And we got desperate and we want to run away from there. But if we understand this, not forever, if I look back in my life, it never lasted forever, any of those moments, but it lasts whatever needs to last. But I have to be there and allow the experience to teach me the lesson. Yeah. Teresa.
I've kind of been in experience a little bit of this with there was a storm happened at my house, and we're not, like the other day, and we're not able to communicate with them. So I don't know the extent. I do know that everybody is fine, but I really didn't need to be in anxiety about it, because I know I have really good neighbors, and that my neighbors will take care of whatever needs to be taken care of in the emergency. I know that they won't let my friends come to harm, cows come to harm. So I have trust and faith that my neighbors will show up. So then when I was speaking with Rasangi, it kind of spilled over into how I can become uncomfortable with uncertainty. Because although I don't have control, like you often say, it's not out of control. It's in control, and he is our best friend. So I know he's going to take care.
Krishna is a good neighbor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. And that situation, in many other places in the U.S., I've been talking with other devotees, and also, they have not been able to join the meeting.
Does anybody know about Lacho?
I don't know that. Yeah. Something else before we conclude? Karuneshwari.
Thinking about Yamuna's question, which she answered, but not but, this is part of the sentence. I think sometimes you can be used to a certain level of doubts, and that's okay. You've always had them from the beginning and you can cope with them. But sometimes a huge doubt comes, and it's the first time you might have doubted to that extent. And then that's for me when it's really scary, because I never actually question that before. Can seem really sort of earth shattering. And I totally know that other people, other devotees, have faced those doubts and then come through it. If that is really, really scary. And that, from my experience, that went on for quite some time. And I wouldn't want to look at it, keep doing all the things. Get up, chant your mantras, watch your deities, and meanwhile don't want my deity anymore. Those kind of doubts. As if it's possible. Have I outgrown deity worship? As if that's a possibility. But those kind of thoughts are so shocking.
But at the same time, we may need to allow them. In this, I'm not saying just promote doubt and leave the practice altogether. I'm not saying that, but don't repress doubt either, because many times we have doubts, we do not acknowledge them sincerely, and we may become just like fanatics and blind followers because we don't want to confront doubts. And of course, as you say, it's so scary to allow them to come and what to speak to, verbalize them outside of ourselves. It's just scary for us to ourselves to contemplate them. What to speak if they happen to know that I have this doubt. So that's why, again, the importance of having safe space and sacred circle where you can even present some of those things and nobody's like, oh, how you dare to have that doubt? No, you're engaging in apostasy. You are leaving the whole practice. You're a heretic. Because we may be, that's our fear many times. They happen to know my doubt. I will be exiled from the tribe. And I will be by myself alone. And I won't belong. And who wants that? So, but we need also to do something with those doubts. And many times we are not able to do something by ourselves. We need to expose them and share them and heal them in circle. And many times when we do that, we realize that other people say, I also had that doubt.
Yeah.
Oh, I also had, and I was like, oh, wow. Because if not, we self-isolate ourselves in our doubts, and that can become terrifying. And we need safe space, safe circle. Like, hopefully we are trying to create these days here where we can just express those things and be accepted because of our doubts, with our doubts, not despite our doubts. And normalize doubts, normalize failure, normalize crisis. No, again, not promoting that. It's not like, let's have as many crises as we can, but also let's acknowledge realistically that's part of the journey. So we were talking with Manjwali these days. Many times this expression will come with all the stuff that many times we are like traumatized about. It's like, that's part of the journey. 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 No, that's part of the journey. Normalize the journey. No, it's not just like, speaking about journey, safe travels, Martina.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they're if they will come on time.
So. Okay, that's part of the journey as well.
Let's see.
Uncertainty. Let us know. Yeah, let us know if we need to get some other car or something.
Yeah, I mean, let's see.
Okay. So anyhow, basically that's... But yeah, I think it's there's a place to have those, to allow ourselves to have those doubts and to try to seek. It's not that, okay, allow myself to have the doubt, to feed the doubt and with all my intention to, like a justification to live, no? Because sometimes that can be happening. No, I'm having this doubt and it's a valid doubt. I need to accept it, express it, and hopefully solve it in one way or another. No? I mean, sometimes some doubts will stay for some time. And that happens, no? Mystery and knowing what will happen with my life. I mean, I don't want again to enter into my unauthorized biography, but I've been for some time like, I don't know what's going on here. Mm-hmm. I know what to do tomorrow. And everything was shattered from one day to another. And like, okay, thrown into mystery for a few months, years. And again, it's complex, no? It's complex and comfortable, it's unsettling. It's not like comfort zone. Everything is clear, predictable. It's exactly the opposite. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if you open to that sincerely, there is so much light coming, so much shelter, so much hope, so much. I speak from my experience. It's not that nothing is coming. No, maybe something is a doubt and will remain a doubt, but we should be able to turn to so many other things that are coming in that moment. It's not that, okay, I have this doubt. It's a crisis. It's a huge thing, probably. But it's not the only thing happening. Even in the worst tragedy you are going through, just again talking for myself, that's big enough to not be able to forget it. It's there in your face. But so much is coming on top of that. But we have, of course, to allow us to see that. We may need a few days. In the beginning, we may be just shocked and the thing is here and it's the only thing that there is and we feel desperate. And again, that's what we need. People that we can just be ourselves and share our hearts, and it's like, I'm a mess and I'm feeling this and this is happening, and it's like, welcome, come on. Now it's your turn. It was my turn last year, it will be your turn next week. Again, it's part of the journey. So as we are able to normalize it, I think that's the most important. Not so much if I have the doubt, don't have the doubt, have the crisis, not have the crisis. That may happen, may not happen. We should be ready to normalize what's part of the journey, so to say. I mean,
I'm just saying, I was listening and I'm thinking the doubt must have one moment not been there and then have been there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also the doubt can't be something external. It's not like a cloud that goes around and like, so it's internal.
Mm-hmm.
So we're taking on doubt at certain times, so we could, although we've run with it, doubt is such like a strong experience that we run with it over time. But if we could take it back to, it must be a root or an event or a moment, and that doubt like seeded itself. And as you've been saying, you know, it's like time. Not to I mean, one of the great things I've got from this week is it's like, you know, Krishna is ever fresh. Krishna is like constantly renewing and growing, but yet we have that tendency to get stuck in clock time and calendar and everything. I think it was back then, a little compartment back here. And sometimes we forget that we're here and then we're going to be there and there and then. But to try and look into that, what's that seed of doubt? Where did it come from? What is that motion? What lies beyond that, behind that? And what lies behind that? That's therapy. To be a master therapist. But that's just an observation for me.
Thank you. And doubt is not a bad word, again. Right? No. Actually, it's taking us closer to Krishna, no? Even if it's bewildering and it's unsettling. It's not that doubt is ontologically bad. It's actually a new level of answer. Again, we are no longer satisfied with certain level of reality. We are invited for more. So that creates like a question or like a doubt and a quest. So as long as we frame doubts positively, we will be okay with them. We will welcome them when they come. Okay, we're going to continue later so it doesn't become too late. But before we conclude, of course, we have 1 second exercise to do throughout the day. Whenever you have time, hopefully you have time. And will be a trust exercise of embracing the unknown. First I fall, maybe we can do this fall backward exercise and you'll be in receive. But I thought about another one. But you can do it if you want. You can be part of the exercise. You know that one, no? That someone is like, and you fall with eyes closed and someone else is.
You don't want people.
Yeah. Do it properly. Yeah. But let's do a small variation of that. It's kind of in the same direction. So the idea is to practice, the intention of the exercise will be to practice faith in the midst of uncertainty, right? Of what we cannot control in a group building, trust building group experience. So the idea is hopefully the day accompanies, that will depend if it's not rain. I checked the weather report before thinking about the exercise. And they say it will be cloud, there may be some water, but I think it will be. You can even do it with umbrellas, so it's okay. So the idea is like this. We will make groups of three to see if the number allows. And we will do this following. We will take a walk outside in groups of three. So one of the three will be walking with eyes closed. Oh. But don't get scared. The other two will be on each side of the person, whether holding hands or taking them by the arm, like supporting, not accompanying. So those guides are representing your guides, no? God's presence, your guardians in your life, no? So you are walking with eyes closed, and that symbolizes the journey of navigating mystery, navigating doubt, navigating uncertainty. So the walk will be in silence, and you have to try to be present to what's coming, no? In connection to this journey, trusting how the divine is carrying you through uncertainty in this journey of faith journey. So try, while in silence and walking and being guided, try to pay attention to your inner responses. So, and after that, I'm thinking we can do it like for 5 minutes, one person. So you can walk, you can accompany, and then you can maybe share for a few minutes before shifting turns, no, with the other person. The three, the idea that the three are doing the walking. So maybe you can walk for 5 minutes and then share. The person who was being guided can share. Then you switch. Someone else is guided. You can share. So 5 minutes walk and the sharing, we never know. I can say 5 minutes and it's been 2 hours. But I'm thinking better to share in between so everyone is just sharing after the immediate experience. No? So you can share how did it feel to trust in the midst of uncertainty, basically. No. So how can this physical experience of trust can mirror, again, the spiritual practice of faith as being the opposite of certainty? Yeah, it's clear the idea?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you can do it whenever you want, hopefully before today's Q&A in the evening. And tomorrow morning, we'll have our next topic, which is quite related to today's topic. We'll be talking about contemplative prayer, no? The realm of contemplative prayer, which is a lot about connecting with mystery, ever-evolving relationship with the divine, and so on. So that will be tomorrow morning. So we can conclude here. Sri Sachinandan Gaur Hari Ki Jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan Ki Jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Ki Jai, Panchakalpatarubhyascha Kripasindubhyaiva Cha Patitanam Bhavanam.